Impulse. Der KPMG-Podcast.
Willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe unseres KPMG-Impulse-Podcasts. Heute zum Thema Cybersecurity und bei mir zu Gast ist Stéphane Duguin vom Cyber Peace Institute. As we are running this interview in English, we are switching now to English and take it from there in English language and have a closer look about the challenges and the ongoing challenges we are facing in the cyber world. Hello and welcome to our new edition of our KPMG podcast Impulse. My name is Robert Lamprecht. I'm a partner at KPMG. And today with me is Stéphane Duguin, CEO of Cyber Peace Institute. Hello, Stéphane, and great to have you in our podcast today.
Thank you so much for the invite. It's a pleasure.
You are the CEO of the Cyber Peace Institute. And as not all of the people are familiar with the Cyber Peace Institute, can you tell us a little bit more about your work and what the Cyber Peace Institute does in particular?
With pleasure. So the Cyber Peace Institute is a non-for-profit based in Geneva, Switzerland. And it's still quite a young organization because we've been created at the end of 2019, December. What we do is providing support on cybersecurity to the most vulnerable. And we focus on NGOs. We are best known as the NGO which provides free cybersecurity to the other NGOs, specifically humanitarian. And we do this in the context of looking for systemic changes. So not only we provide this free support, but also we analyze independently the big threats that are out there in cyberspace. And we use this knowledge in order to inform policymakers. The whole idea here is that if there's better laws, if there's better regulation, if there's better enforcement of norms and laws by the states, logically, there should be systemic change so that the vulnerable communities are not vulnerable anymore.
You mentioned a few times now vulnerable communities. How do you see vulnerable communities, or what is encompassed and what is included in vulnerable communities?
So we decided early in our strategy to focus our services, our free services, to non-for-profit, to NGOs. So we help in majority humanitarian NGOs, but all type of organization really who comes to us. We have now a program through which we provide free cybersecurity to more than 250 NGOs globally. And it's a program that will scale to 1,000 NGOs to the end of 2025. And interesting one, because when you talk about vulnerable communities, to your question, you also need to identify who is in capacity to help them. And this program, the Cyber Peace Builders, is getting support from the private sector, from cyber volunteers in the private sector, who provide their time, their talent, I would even argue their hearts, in order to support for free NGOs, for a lot of them in the front lines.
So I understand it's quite a lot of community work. So in order to share the experiences that we have in the private sector and giving them to others who are not or don't have the ability to get to this knowledge in an easy way.
Yeah, indeed. The big ambition would be to connect each and every cyber professional with each and every NGOs in the world. That's the big vision. And in fact, to reverse the equation and to make the non-for-profit sector the most cyber secure sector of the planet. Why? If you look at non-for-profit in cyber, but outside of cyber, a lot of time these organizations, like us, are doing the job that in the end no one else really is doing or wants to do. Is the job in the front line, is the job to support the most vulnerable in the direst situation. And strangely enough, this bubble of do good, of social impact, of societal help is non-protected in cyberspace. So these organizations are under attack every day by criminal groups or by state actors. And that's why we decided to focus on this community.
So in a way, it's like those, the ones that are doing something good for society, the ones that are trying to improve society for the better, are being attacked by others, and therefore we need to protect them in order for them to do their work.
Yeah, because if we don't protect them, we don't protect ourselves. It's kind of simple.
In your previous role, you worked with Europol, where you led major international cybercrime, counterterrorism, and hybrid threats operation. You also investigated on threat actors deploying cyber attacks, illegal content, and disinformation techniques. From your point of view, what are the biggest differences between Austria and other countries that you have seen in the approach to cybercrime and to cyber threats?
It's an interesting as complicated question, in the sense that for each state, Austria included, the strategy that you put in place in order to be cyber secure, but at the same time to have capacity to investigate cybercrime, is scattered. And it's scattered because historically a lot of enforcement when it comes to police and justice has been organized from the crime basis, and cyber, you know, follow down, but late. And it's a very different community than the one that is managing the network, the one that is making sure that network are secure. And that's more the cybersecurity, you know, community. So as in every country, I would say that having a holistic approach suffers from the disconnection sometimes still between the cybersecurity community and the law enforcement and judicial community. That's for to a start. To the second point, as many other countries, Austria is impacted by the sheer nature of cyber attacks, which is transnational. So there's no country which alone can do anything. The whole point here, when it comes to thinking defense, when it comes to building resilience, when it comes to investigating crime, when it comes to identifying perpetrators and hold them to account, you need to have international cooperation. And from that front, Austria is a bit better than others because Austria is in the European Union. So can benefit from a lot of tools and capacity that the EU is providing and making available, such as Europol, where I was working before, but for example, the Council of Europe, which is not the EU, but it's a European centric based construct, and a lot of bilateral agreements in between states. I would argue also that Austria is one of these countries who early on decided to have a cyber ambassador. In order to be in capacity also to have a specific representation at the highest level on diplomatic fora to discuss about cyber. And that's also quite a good investment.
So would you say that it is imperative or it is beneficial for other countries also to have cyber ambassadors? Is it a requirement in diplomacy? I hate it.
It's a tough word, huh?
Yeah,
especially these days, diplomacy, it's a complicated word. So I guess this is coming from that. Joke aside, it's very important how you have your diplomats who are very, very versed in cyber, and they can always understand the cyber part of the conversation they are having, whatever the specialty, but it's very tough. Or you make sure that you have a central point of contact, reference, someone that really knows in depth all the cyber processes and can voice the position of one state, or can also translate how the position of one state relates to the bloc in which the state is happening, in Austria context, the EU and other, you know, like-minded coalition. So I'd say it's quite important.
Or Austria has also implemented a tech diplomat, so someone who is keeping relationships with the big tech firms in Silicon Valley, in conjunction with cyber diplomacy. Would you assume that also these roles are mandatory in the future because of the dominant role of these tech companies from the Valley?
We should never forget that cyberspace is a technical construct. So it's a construct of networks interconnected, and the vast majority of this network are owned by the private sector. That's the big difference between, let's say, the real world and the virtual world, if you think about it. So this creates a space where the technology is owned by the private sector, but at the same time, the regulation for what you can do not to do in this space is the responsibility of states, like for the rest of sectors that are under regulation. So it's quite important that you have people that are specialized into discussing with the right stakeholder. So I guess Austria's choice, but I will not comment the rationale because I don't know, but I guess, was to say there's a need to have a deep coordination and discussion with the one that are the big actors in cyberspace from the tech point of view. And at the same time, there's a need to have a very in-depth conversation with the diplomats of this world on the regulation point of view, which are looking into cyber issues, I guess. So it's not, to me, it's not sure.
Okay. In general, favorable, but obviously dependent on the situation and the decision of each and every country, how they want to presume in, or how they want to proceed for the challenges in this field.
It is because you specialize, you can also have quite a strong, you know, positioning and insights to provide to the rest of the community. Look in the last open-ended working group in the United Nations in December. I mean, Austria stressed that the work of the group was to reaffirm certain principles to be applicable in cyber conflict. So suddenly you have the know-how and the capacity to talk about something that is very important now, you know, the rules of law in the context of conflict. So Austria reminded about the principle of sovereignty, of peaceful settlement of disputes, of prohibition of the use of force, non-intervention. So it's quite important to put all these notions in the cyber context, and you can only do this if you know what you're talking about.
That brings me also to another question when it comes to international cooperation, because as you already said before, doing something by yourself in a complex world and in a connected world becomes much more difficult. So we know that international cooperation is important when it comes to solving problems related to cybercrime. What do you see as the biggest challenges to international cooperations? How could we improve them?
In order to tackle the cyber threats, you need to have a certain level of trust in between countries. It's quite important. You cannot achieve international cooperation without this on several layers. Take the very practical layer. If you want to investigate cyber crime, cyber attack, you need to cooperate with other states, because there's no way that the culprit, the infrastructure used, the attack deployed, and the victim are all in one country. That would be like the exception of the exception of the exception. So international cooperation is critical between states. At the same time, you need to have international cooperation in a multi-stakeholder approach. You need also to cooperate with the private sector in other countries a lot of time. You need to cooperate with civil society in other countries in order to get the holistic view around, you know, a cyber case. That's on one end. On the other end, especially since the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, you need to have confidence-building measures in between countries so that they trust each other when discovering that they are under attack or one of their allies under attack, and that they trust that if someone says this is not me, it's really not that state. And that's, to me, the biggest threat today when it comes to escalation since the invasion of Ukraine, because there's so many actors which participate to the hostilities. We, Cyber Peace Institute, so we have this public platform, and I invite our auditors to look into it. It's a free service that we provide since the invasion, where we trace the attacks that are happening in the context of this aggression. And we could trace more than 120 threat actors which are active in the conflict. It's a pure escalation. So what's going to happen if tomorrow, let's dream, there would be a ceasefire in between the Federation of Russia and Ukraine? Do we think that these 120 plus threat actors are going to stop the cyber attack? And how can you make sure that when there's an attack with a victim, and today, by the way, these attacks are impacting more than 53 countries in the world. It's already a global conflict in cyberspace. So how do you make sure that when there's an attack, you know exactly from which country this is coming, and you can trust that this country is going to tell you, yes, this is me or not me, or I don't know. And that's the big issue of trust today in cyberspace.
But in particular, or in order to establish trust, and trust is a very important thing when it comes to, as you said, when it comes to international cooperation. Is it only, how can we establish that trust? Is it only by looking at each other's face and say, hey, I know you and you know me? Or is it, I don't attack you, you don't attack me? Or how can this work in a digital world? When we see each other in reality, I have a censorship, as an individual seeing, okay, I see you, can I trust you as a person or not? How can we leverage that into the digital space?
I may have it may have not been clear just before. I don't think there's another level of trust in cyberspace and outside of cyberspace. That's a mental construct. There's a level of trust dot. And today we see that multilateralism is very complicated to keep as a principle with the United Nations, for example. And the trust in between countries is on the decline, especially if you look at the bloc between like China and the US and Russia and what is happening now with the attack in Gaza from Israel. I mean, this also is eroding trust. And then this erosion of trust is impacting any cooperation when it comes to cyber attacks. And because it's way easier to obfuscate, to manipulate information in the context of a cyber attack, then you need much more trust in between partners so that allies are going to stay allies, that former agreement of not to attack civilian is going to be enforced, that spying in your critical infrastructure is not going to happen. It's much more complicated today because the level of trust is very low. That's one thing. The second thing is the rules. The rules are not, I'm sorry, for the minimum not clear and for the maximum not even enforced. So if you look at your the norms of responsible behavior in cyberspace, these are norms where states need to voluntarily abide to. So not only they are not like mandatory rules of behavior, that's already a flaw to my reading, but on top of that, no one is really even measuring if they are implementing or not. And that doesn't help the trust. So I would argue that if you want to solve this, it always starts the same. You need to have like some states taking the lead, making pledges, living up the ambition of the norms, living up the ambitions of the law, proposing treaties, but like honest treaties. And I will come back to that when they consider that there's something missing. And from, you know, like-minded critical group, you can spread, you know, a certain form of logic in order to implement this trust. The issue is that the forum where this is supposed to happen, meaning the United Nations, is quite, it's not very strong from that point of view lately. So it's difficult to have this discussion existing.
So in a way, we can achieve trust if we lead by example, if we motivate others also to do what we are doing and demonstrating that in the things we do, collaboration and working together can be improved, and therefore they follow our ambitions or our mindset also in order to improve trust and in order to improve collaboration. So it's in a way, if we do it in a way, if we lead by example, then others will follow.
At least there's a theory, but what else? What else is out there? But sometimes what could be easy to implement is not even done. Look at the European Union. So you have a block of 27 countries where rules and have been settled, have been agreed upon. And there's supposed to be a high level of trust between the countries. And in the cyberspace, you still have issues. Look at cyber espionage, look at the deployment of spyware, look at the fact that in the EU it's still possible to import, export, dual-use tools in order to spy on EU citizens. And when sometimes these EU citizens are from the parliament, or from the government, or from big corporations, how block like the EU, where we're supposed to have the highest standard of regulation of trust, is letting this be? For me, that's the start. You start, you know, doing things in the ecosystem that you can control. And then when it's clean in front of your door, you can start discussing with the rest of the world and give lessons.
In a way, demonstrate that it's important for you, like you probably followed the discussions or the ambitions of the European Union to make the NIS directive, in the directive to protect our critical infrastructure, and each member state has to transfer it into national law. In a way, the discussions for implementing that or for transferring that law into local law is a process which is sometimes easier or sometimes more difficult for member states. Nevertheless, it should be every member state's ambition to protect their critical infrastructure, because we want to survive as a society and we want to have a stable society. And if our information systems are impacted by cyber attacks, society can be destabilized and therefore impacted. So it should be in general more the nature of the ambition of the country, right?
the nature of the ambition and the action that you're putting in place in order to follow up your ambition. That's also quite important. Now, the EU is quite advanced when it comes to proposing regulation to enforce both cybersecurity, as you're mentioning, like reporting after cyber attack, specific standards when it comes to security and resilience, but also international cooperation within the bloc on cybercrime investigation. So there's some fields that are quite advanced, and looking to what is at least thought through, even if nothing is perfect, in the Cyber Resilience Act, it is under negotiation, or the Cyber Solidarity Act of the EU. These are excellent initiatives. Now, the truth is in implementation. The issue with the EU is even reverse, is that there's so many digital legislation that have been discussed between like several years ago to some years to come. I mean, look at it. It's from the GDPR to NIS2, via the Cyber Resilience Act, via the AI Act and the Digital Services Act and the Terrorist Content Online Regulation, and so on and so on. All of this is touching the different stack of the internet, meaning from the infrastructure, looking into what has been cybersecurity, but up to the content which is floating in the pipeline. And all of this every time has an impact on everyone. So if implementation is not very thorough, and more importantly, if implementation is not making sense, because sometimes these frameworks are contradicting with each other, and then that's when you lose the citizen and you lose the support and you erode, to your question, the trust.
Bring it now from the government level and from the national level to the organizations, to the companies, to the ones that are doing business, and you're supporting NGOs and the like, and you also have a pretty good overview about the ongoing threats and challenges. Can you give us an insight? What are currently the most prevalent cybersecurity threats that businesses are facing nowadays?
Well, sadly enough, there's nothing new. You know, it's always this question where we hope we have something new to say, and there's not. I mean, the depends on the numbers that you're looking at, but it's at least 80 to 90% of attacks which could be avoided with very basic cyber hygiene. It's sad, but it's still the case. So when it comes to, if you made the difference between the threat and the resilience, on the resilience side, there's a lot of effort to be made that are still not made. And let's start there because of the numbers. You know, this equation, you spend 20% of your time doing something and you get 80% of return on investment. So that's to me in this realm. The second bit is the threat itself. I was mentioning like that before. Since the invasion of Ukraine, proliferation of threat actors, because of proliferation of threat actors, proliferation of the threat. And depending on the businesses and size and the profile, nothing new again. Ransomware, still high on the mark, clearly. Everything that is around acceleration of crime via scams, via phishing, social engineering, with the fact that AI is accelerating this, augmenting it. I would not say it's a game changer for that, but it's augmenting, that's for sure. So it's cyber augmentation for criminals. And with this, you have quite a nice panorama. Because of our position and what we look at the Cyber Peace Institute, I would add two things. The fact that some civilians are taking enormous risk in participating to conflicts in cyberspace, answering the calls being from the Federation of Russia or being from Ukraine in order to, participate to DDoS attack or you name it. When you do that, I don't think people realize that they target civilian objects in the context of a conflict. So there could be a very problematic impact to the action. That's one. And that's, I think, people need to wake up. And then the second part is that they are waiving potentially their civilian status because they could be considered by the party targeted by the attack as combat under international humanitarian law. And that would be a big issue in the sense that when doing this, they are sitting somewhere in the world, bringing their infrastructure, bringing then their country potentially into the conflict. And that's a big issue when it comes to the complexity of the threats. This empowerment of civilians in a conflict. And I mentioned that before. I will end on this, is the threat that is accelerated by irresponsible behavior of states, and specifically everything around surveillance and spyware. So states today are fueling with money, with taxpayer money, a market of surveillance. So because a lot of states, they cannot themselves develop and produce software, hardware, you name it, in order to do surveillance, a lot of times, sometimes to break encryption, then there's this kind of acceptance that private sector entities are to be contracted to do it, which is very dangerous. First, you finance with taxpayer money skills in another country in order to perform cyber attacks, because a spyware operation is a cyber attack. That's quite simple. But on top of that, you decide that it's more important to keep everyone insecure in order to have the capacity at one point to hit one target. Okay, we can argue it's legitimate or not. We can look into the check and balance in between national security and privacy. We can do a lot of things. But at the end of the day, it's difficult for me for states to say on one end, we want everyone to be cyber secure. So we put out there a program for cybersecurity, resilience, we invest million. And at the same time, the same states make sure that they're stockpiling vulnerabilities via proxies, private sector, so that each phone on the planet is insecure, so that at one point they can target one phone. This is, to me, quite strange.
You mentioned before the status of the civilians that are participating in conflicts. From your point of view, are civilians aware, are always aware of the consequences of participating in acts of war? Is it a false understanding of heroism?
No, they're not aware. And I don't think civilians are better informed than everyone else. Everyone. No one is really well informed when it comes to the legal implication of your act in cyberspace, because it's a world that has been made for us so frictionless, so easy. Then you tend to lose the sense of consequences and meaning. And it's a world where accountability is not really, you know, out there every day. So if you would be accountable as soon as you perform hate speech on the internet, as soon as you put a stalkerware in the phone of your ex-partner, there would be accountability every time that you decide to download an executable and perform a DDoS attack somewhere on the other end of the planet, it could be different. But that's not the case. So no, I would say that the level of understanding is very low.
So as the understanding is low, how can businesses protect on the one hand themselves, but also their employees? Because they do have a kind of responsibility to protect also their employees and make them part of the whole, let me say, protection ecosystems, and also their customers, like from these threats and so on. Mm-hmm. What should we prepare for the future?
I mean, there's two approaches to this. At least the one is the logical one. People think about their own perimeter, and they consider that they need to secure their own walls. So they go into sometimes purchasing cybersecurity services or contracting, making training internally. I'm talking about an organization as an ecosystem. So you try to make sure that you're the most resilient possible. But the thing is that with how the threat is evolving, it's almost impossible in the sense that first, everyone is dependent on the supply chain. It's very rare for any organization today to own end-to-end all the software that they are going to use in order to perform the job. At some point, you depend on the cybersecurity of someone else, and that someone else is not even in your country. So that's one. So this securization of the perimeter is something to strive for, but we need to be conscious of the limits. But something that I see missing is how to build up a culture of cybersecurity in entities. It's good for your organization, and it's good for the people working there. It's kind of why we decided to launch the Cyber Peace Builders program, because we partner with private sector entities, and these entities provide to us funds and volunteers, cyber volunteers, so people who understand a bit better than the average citizen the problematic of cyber, with a lot of time a technical background. And we make sure that these volunteers can help NGOs in quasi real time. So it's kind of a virtuous circle, because you have on one end, non-for-profits, humanitarian, for example, which are already in the front line, and they don't have nor the money nor the capacity, and they cannot attract the talent, you know, to protect themselves. And on the other end, you have the talents, and they are working for big companies, which they like. That's not the problem. But usually when you go into cybersecurity, it's because you want to do good. You want to protect something. You want to investigate a threat. So being provided with the opportunity to do that, few hours here and there, but to help, NGOs, is not only good for society, but it opens the eye of these people about the reality of what is happening beyond their ecosystem, beyond their walls. And that's how you start thinking about the interconnectivity of resilience. And that's where you can scale and change. I mean, there's a cultural shift that is needed to understand how we are interdependent with each other. And thinking of cybersecurity alone is meaningless.
You mentioned a very important point at the beginning when you came up with the culture of cybersecurity. So when I understand you right, the culture of cybersecurity is more than simply doing awareness trainings by means of how can I protect myself and where I must not click on that link and how to handle passwords properly. So is it about the attitude towards approaching cybersecurity and threats? Is it that what you're referring to when it comes to cybersecurity culture?
Okay, some points about culture, and it's not going to be exhaustive because there's so many aspects to it, but let's try to make a list. Something that I find shocking is this, you know, saying that in cybersecurity, the problem is between the chair and the keyboard. So this is, okay, it's an interesting joke, but it's a bit meaningless in the sense that it's very easy to count when people are making mistakes, but how do you even count every time that they're not clicking, every time that they're not forwarding, every time that they are, you know, something is happening there and they did the right thing to protect the organization? Who is counting this? No one. So I would nuance the joke that I mentioned before. And I'm putting this in the context of culture because this is how you create a culture in an organization. It's a positive culture. So it's about, you know, welcoming things that have been well done, you know, making the champions of security when you can. And it's also not hitting with the on the head, you know, people that are making mistakes, because everyone can make a mistake. And at one point, it's going to be you, it's going to be me. I mean, where no one is smarter than anyone else. There's always going to be someone who will understand the way you think and would reverse engineer your thinking into an attack and manipulate you. That's just, you know, the way things work. So we need to be very humble about this. Organization that I saw putting this in place, so championing the successes, giving space to debrief the failure, but without being punitive about it. Something else I find extremely strange, that in organizations that are having multi-million budget, or even the small one, for the one who can afford it, the chief information security officer is the sole person in responsibility, so accountable for cybersecurity. This is nonsensical. That you have someone that is the expert, someone that can be the go-to person, that organizes the resources, that makes the right choices, that helps the strategy, of course. But when it comes to accountability, each manager, each leader should be accountable. It should be the chief finance officer, the chief information officer, the chief whatever officer, where in their own verticals should have KPIs on how they implement cybersecurity. And that's how you change a culture. Otherwise, it's too easy. So you consider that the fireman, which is six blocks away from your organization, is the only one in charge of not setting fire in your organization in everyday life of staff. But where are we here?
I really liked your example with the problem between the keyboard and the chair, because we talk most of the time about failures. And in my point of view, shouldn't this be also a responsibility of media? Because in a way, media is always talking about or making press releases if a company has been successfully hacked by another threat actor and so on. But no one is actually reporting and says, we were successful. We haven't been part of that attack because we did our job properly. We survived this and that attack because we did our job. Isn't that also a kind of social responsibility of media?
Yeah, it's so interesting what you're saying. I mean, I worked in counterterrorism for quite some time, and it was interesting to say that when there was an attack, you would get some news coverage, obviously, because people would die and the emotional level would be very high. So I'm not questioning this. But when attack would be waived, when, you know, people would be arrested, it's 10 seconds in the news and someone thinks about something else. That's just human nature. We have to accept it. But there's something interesting in what you're saying in terms of the media responsibility. And that's something that we did in Institute, interfacing with media to at least share with them what we see happening, if depending on the kind of storytelling you do when it comes to cyber attacks. 2 points. The first one is, it was in the COVID-19 that we mentioned that. First wave of COVID-19. Beginning 2020, there was one attack per day on healthcare, at minimum, one attack per day. The coverage was close to zero. And I was always thinking, if every day there would be an armed group with hoodies and guns entering hospital, destroying all the computers and holding the director at gunpoint and say, you give me 15 Bitcoin. When I have them, I'm going to rebuild all your computers every day. I'm pretty sure it will be the 8 o'clock news, but it's not the case. And the second thing is that when this is happening, and that's very different to any crime, is there's this kind of suspicion that the victim, you know, is a bit stupid, made a mistake. The tone is very, you know, like, dismissive to the victim. This never happens with offline crime. If the same hospital would have been attacked by an armed group, the media coverage, the tone would be extremely different than when it happens on the cyber attacks, because we look into, okay, did they patch properly, you know, who is responsible? That's quite interesting. The second thing is that we don't talk enough about harm. We don't talk enough about what these cyber attacks are creating as harm to society. So Cyber Peace Institute, we proposed at the end of last year a methodology in order to measure the harm of cyber attacks. And we are going to stress test this methodology this year through a lot of use cases, from ransomware to conflict to spyware, you name it. So people are hearing this. If you're interested into this work, please contact us, because it's going to get us busy a lot this year. Why I'm mentioning this is because the way you tell a story media-wise again on cyber attack can be quite different. Example, you may know about this case in Finland, Vastamo. It's a clinic that has been attacked 3 years ago, where the attacker entered a clinic and stole all the conversation between the patient and the psychiatrist. So imagine everything that you tell to your psychologist, psychiatrist. Went to the clinic, tried to get a ransom, failed because the people didn't want to pay, and had the crazy idea to make a ransom to each and every patient. 31,000. The ransom was 500 euros. What happened is that people were asked in 2 days to pay, otherwise their secret would be on the internet, and the attacker, to prove ownership of the datasets, upload the dataset on the internet, but the full dataset, which means it's been downloaded since. It's still out there to be downloaded. So now let's look at the media story. How you say what happened is one attacker, you know, got 10K because that's what he could get in ransom. But the real story here is that one cyber attack impacted 0.5% of the Finnish population, led Finland to create one of the biggest victim support entity ever, and created a permanent psychological harm on 31,000 people. And that's a bit different. And if we can move towards this, I think we can get states to think differently into resource investments when it comes to cybersecurity and cybercrime investigation.
Means when we talk about cybercrime, we also must conclude about the individual impacts, or the impacts a data breach, a disclosure, or whatsoever, has on the individual. Because when we talk, for instance, about ransomware cases, we say, okay, companies were encrypted, right? But if personal identifiable information, so PII, is being disclosed or is being released onto the internet, what harm does it cause to the individual? Obviously, we do have GDPR, but GDPR is just the law, but it doesn't really address the implications on the individual. So what implications does this have in terms of psychology and so on?
That's the message that we put in place to measure the harm, the human harm, so like the psychological one, or the environmental harm, the societal one. So it's extremely tough. To be fair, we're not even sure that we are going to succeed, but we really believe that the journey is worth it. That going there and trying to shift the narrative and the storytelling, providing new data, hard data on the cost when it comes to harm to society, could shift the way cyber is thought through from the regulation to the standard point of view.
We also tackled this topic this year in our study, because we were interested whether cyber attacks do have implications on sleep disorders, on burnout, on aggression, and so on. The interesting thing was that quite a big number of participants of our survey said, I don't want to talk about it, which is interesting in one way, because they say, don't touch me, or I don't want to tell it because it's either too personal. But on the other hand, looking at the results, it was interesting to see what effects are being caused by cyber attacks, and we don't address them properly at these days, because we're looking at the technical point of view and say, okay, how can we fix it? We're looking at the organizational point of view, how can we make policies better? But there is still something in between, that's the human, and we don't tackle the human.
No, except to say that the human is a problem, because the human is between the chair and the keyboard, which is a very, you know, dismissive way to look at the issue. To your point, is there's several impacts. So there's the impact on the victims, the people that have been victim of attacks, what happening to them. I remember vividly a conversation with an organization where there was a false flag after a CEO fraud, where the financial officer was for days accused to work with the cyber criminals because no one could think that the person was so wrong to do this transfer. I mean, the person went close to suicide because of this, because of, you know, the what was happening in terms of rumor and in terms of social pressure within the company. Another one is this organization we supported early on in the Cyber Peace Institute called Roots of Peace. It's a not-for-profit from the United States, and they are in Afghanistan removing mines from the field and replacing them by vines. They suffered a cyber attack, lost 1.2 million, and the impact was enormous on their beneficiaries, enormous, and they are part of the food chain there. We're talking about people in between, you know, in the risk of famine. But on top of that, the impact was also on their donors. It was very difficult for them to convince donors to continue to finance their operation because of this tense, you know, of you didn't do your job right when it comes to cyber attack, which is really unique in the criminal ecosystem.
One topic also that gets more and more attention nowadays is also the effect of artificial intelligence, AI. You mentioned it before, one of your answers, that AI is augmenting all these activities. So if we look now at the geopolitical situation, if we look now about the elections that are going on all over the globe, and almost 50% of the world's population is going to vote this year or going towards elections, how much do you think is AI accelerating mis and disinformation? Do we already, or are we already sufficiently enough aware of the consequences that our integrity is at risk? Or is it still for us hard to get what the consequences are?
If you focus on the election for a second, and focus not on the cyber attacks, on the infrastructure of the election, because that's your question, I get it. It's more on the information space. I would say we know that we have a problem because elections are manipulated for decades. And manipulation of election did not change too much in terms of modus operandi. Huh? It's falsification of information, it's influence. And this is happening because the construct, the information construct on the internet allows for it. Meaning that mainly social media platform, but also media, mainstream media, which are taking what is shared in social media platform to put it in mainstream media. All this construct has been abused in the past in the context of elections. So we know. I would like just to remind this because it's important. So AI does not change that. AI gets easier to produce content in order to abuse what we know does not work. So it's nice not suddenly just to talk about AI as if there's this new threat and we haven't seen it coming and, oh my God, what are we going to do? No, we know that elections are manipulated using social media and mainstream media to harm the principle of democracy.
So in a way, it's transferring it onto another level, but also knowing that it has existed for many years, but just the methods or the ways we can use it have changed in a way, and that we use it now in a different information space aside from, let's say, regular physical information.
I guess we did not do our homework properly in solving the problem in the first place. And now we are still facing the same problem where indeed there's going to be a biggest number of elections ever registered into one single year. That's just the way it is. So our hope would be that AI, because we talk about AI, is going to help solve the problem by detecting misinformation, maybe enforcing faster content moderation, and you name it. I was in Lille in the Forum in Cyber for 3 days, where this was the hot topic in most of the panel I participated in. But at the end of the day, no one knew. I just want to highlight that, yes, it augments criminal capabilities. Yes, it gets things more complicated when you look into deepfake, etc. But now, It's not a new threat per se. It's an acceleration of the existing threat.
The reaction of countries of European Union and others are always approaching those new technology threats with new regulations. Do you think we need stronger regulations on an international level for AI?
The problem with regulation with AI now is going to be the train has left the station. So it's try to build the track in front of the train when the train is already ongoing. It's not easy to do, to say the least. The game changer for AI is going to be, just don't know when, we will move from a deterministic part of the AI, meaning I have an idea as a user and I'm using AI to augment my capacity to get my results, which is what is happening today. Two, I could have a model that is so good, it's going to be autonomous to do the thing that I want, even maybe the thing that I don't even know that I want alone. That would be a game changer. That would be a singular new threat. Okay, so we are fearing this, but no one is actually know when this is going to happen. But that's this. To go back to your regulation question, how do you prevent that? How do you manage this? So the AI Act is interesting start, but then we need to put this into operation quite fast into the EU for it to have an impact. But I would say it's not enough. It's I think it would be to recognize among states what are use of technology augmented by AI, which should just not be, and put resources not to make sure that they're not going to happen. With the nature of this technology that is, you have this, okay, you have the big players in AI, the Microsoft, the Google, the Amazon of this world and others, but at the end of the day, the threat is going to come from this connection of individuals that are going to put their brain together and misusing existing tools in order to, like, deepfake. I mean, I don't know if everyone hearing this knows where the name deepfake is coming from. Deepfake is the name of the threat actor who invented the deepfake. So we are calling something with the name of a criminal. It's quite interesting. And it was a Reddit forum who people were participating, and they thought it was very intelligent to, at the time, abuse the data, the processing power, and the availability of personal data to create this fake porn video by putting the face of one lady on the body of another one. And this created a singular threat to evidence, to proof, crazy amount of gender-based violence. And this was not done because a company sold the product. This was not done because something was researched and developed into an EU project. No, this was done because there's an interconnection of brain. This is the cyberspace, and something, poof, just pop. So at that moment, I would say the only response is for states to focus on the usage, and to drive hard on accountability. And because AI is already on the run, I do not see anything else to be happening on the short term like this.
So in a way, if a new technology comes, we must be aware whether we are already in the train and how we can maneuver the train on a given track, or change the tracks of the train, even though knowing it's already on the move.
Yeah. And
it's already in the move brings me already to my last question, because looking towards the future and predicting the future is always something interesting to see whether our predictions become true or not. So if we both meet each other again in 1 year, what would you wish we have already done today?
1 year is nice, because 1 year is still, you know, the probable future. Beyond, I would not be so sure. I'd like to come back to measure how well we could change the narrative around the harm caused by cyber attacks and cyber operations. That would be one, so that we can really see, okay, we were talking about this in one way 1 year ago, we are talking about this in a new way now, and it looks like it's helpful, it's empowering victims, and it's giving them the right voice, and policymakers, regulators, magistrates can understand this in order to drive accountability. That's one. The second would be that there's been enough effort in states to see if we do need or not a new treaty or new regulation when it comes to cyber. You're mentioning AI, why not? But something, do we really need this? Or are problems that we're not implementing the existing one good enough? My issue is that we're not even there, because we don't implement what we have in the right way. It's very difficult for us to know if a new one would help by the time of the negotiation, etc. So that would be interesting. The third one would be to connect better the cybersecurity community with the reality of the regulation they are living in. I mean, I was in Lille last week. It was very funny. We had this panel with amazing other speaker, to be honest. I was listening to the colleagues in the panel, and I was amazed by the knowledge and expertise, and the room was empty. And the room was empty because we were talking about norms, about regulation, about proliferation, about cyberspace, the construct. And in this forum were cybersecurity professionals, and this is not their world. So how crazy is that the one doing the cybersecurity, managing the pipe, securing it, are not interested with the whole regulation space that is happening around them? And in 1 year time, if we can solve that and connect this, I would be very pleased.
That's a very interesting point. So in a way, security people don't understand their impact on society and what implications.
It maybe sounds dismissive to say they don't understand. All very small people, I think, is never proven useful to them.
Okay.
And that's the thing, when something is never useful to you, is never impacting you, why would you be interested?
And then we are back again at the effect and the successes we have from doing security properly and demonstrating the successes. And when we talk about the effects of our, or the success of our work, people will appreciate it more and maybe people will invest more and say, okay, it makes sense what we're doing. It has benefit for society, it has benefit for the people, it has benefit for us all.
Indeed. And because of impact and success, my last thought for in 1 year time would be that thanks to this podcast, we would have attracted a lot of companies and a lot of cyber volunteers to give their time to protect for free NGOs and would reach these 1,000 NGOs that are way more mature in their journey of cybersecurity because they are the ones protecting us in this complicated world.
I can't imagine a better closing statement from you than this one, so that we all together protect our society. Stephen, thank you very much for the time and for having the opportunity of talking to you and sharing your insights with the audience. For those of you listening to our podcast, thank you very much for joining us and stay tuned for another episode of our KPMG Impulse podcast. Thank you and have a great day.
Impulse. Der KPMG-Podcast. Jetzt reinhören unter kpmg.at/impulse.